The time is at hand for the establishment of the Redeemer's kingdom. Our understanding and our thought is that the kingdom for which we and many other Christians have been praying for some 2,000 years is being established. It's not something that's going to start in the future. It's something that's happening right now. The tumultuous events that are occurring in the earth, the dizzying pace at which things are changing, are indeed a sign of the incoming kingdom. And you know, we expect the events of earth are going to become even more dizzying, more tumultuous, more intense as we approach that time of the complete glorification of the church. Now, our purpose for the next 50 minutes or so is going to be to examine this conclusion. Is it correct? Is it scriptural that the time is now for the establishment of the Redeemer's kingdom? You know, we do feel some degree of sadness in our hearts when we hear that some of the Lord's people have either abandoned or diluted portions of the harvest message, especially volumes 2 and 3 and 4. We certainly give them the benefit of the doubt that they mean well, but it saddens us when we hear about these things. We don't have any intention of antagonizing or of offending others who do not share our enthusiasm for this portion of the harvest message. But to illustrate the matter to our minds, if we remove volumes 2, 3, and 4 from our spiritual diets, it would be like removing the meat from our sandwich. Plenty of starch, but not much protein. By the way, we're not downplaying the starch. They're both equally important in any well-balanced diet. But our purpose today is we want to share publicly the exhilaration that we ourselves have gotten from the 10 gems that are contained in Volume 2. We want to re-examine the entire volume in the next 48 minutes. We want to see the luster of this volume. We want to see its beauty. We want to see its symmetry. And most of all, we want to see how that this work is not of man, but of God. As we go through our lesson together today, we're going to be looking for two things. First, we want to identify from each chapter in that work, Volume 2, we want to identify the main gem. There's all kinds of gems, we realize, and it was arbitrary that we should pick the number 10, but it just happens to be 10 chapters in the volume. So obviously we're going to pick one gem from each chapter. But secondly, in addition to identifying that one gem, we want to see how each gem relates to and supports every other gem in that volume. We want to see how each acts as a building block for the conclusion that the time is at hand. Chapter 1. Special times and seasons divinely appointed. Well, what's the golden gem that we find in the first chapter? Well, we believe that the gem that's embedded in this chapter is that time is a vital part of God's plan. Now, that's nothing new, and it's fairly simplistic. But time, we would say, is of the essence in God's plan. Now, what do we mean when we say the time is of the essence? Well, how many of us have ever bought a piece of land or a piece of a home and signed an agreement? Probably many of us have done that. Did you remember seeing a phrase in that agreement that says, time is of the essence? It's in most agreements, at least back in our area. Did you know what you signed? Did you know what it meant? Time is of the essence. Well, friends, let me start off by suggesting what this phrase does not mean. Sometimes the best way you can understand what something is to understand what it is not. Time is of the essence does not mean that time is merely an important part of the plan of God. It doesn't mean that time is merely an important part of a transaction. The phrase time is of the essence means that time is an absolutely vital, integral part of the deal, of the transaction. Okay, time for an example. You're buying a home. You need to sell your old home. The bank where you borrowed the money from says that you have to close, you must close on your loan on the first day of October, or they'll cancel your loan. Your loan commitment runs out. But you have to sell your old home in order to come up with the down payment to make this deal work. So, you entered into an agreement to sell your old house. Now, because of very tight circumstances, which are frequently the case, the one who is buying your old home cannot close the deal until September the 30th. Now, remember, you have to close on your loan on October the 1st, or you're out of luck. Would you say that time is important for you to close on your deal of your old house on September the 30th? I wouldn't. I would say that time is of the essence. I would say that it's absolutely vital for your buyer to agree to close on your deal on September the 30th. If your buyer fails to close your deal on September the 30th, your whole house of cards just came down because the whole thing isn't going to work. Clearly, time is an integral. Time is a critical. Time is a vital part of your contract. It's not just important. It's vital. It's vitally linked to the heart of the transaction. Obviously, that's a crude example. But we're just trying to use that to stress a point. Time is of the essence in all of the features of God's plan. Why? Because time is woven in some way, directly or indirectly. Time is interwoven in every feature of the divine plan. And if anything becomes out of sync or mixed up or so on, why, we're going to wind up with total chaos. But that's the golden gem, we believe, that we find in that first chapter to introduce us. And as a matter of fact, we can relate back to our Ecclesiastes study just a little bit ago in 3:1. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. There's not too much, if anything, in God's plan that's not somehow connected with time. Chapter 2, Bible Chronology. I'm sure you remember the general content of this chapter. The unbroken chain of human history that runs from creation well beyond 1874, as we extend it out. But what's the value to you and to me to have this unbroken human history, this unbroken chronology of human history that's all laid out before us? Well, first of all, we would say that having this timeline, so to speak, this chronology of human history, provides us a means whereby we can accurately compare one prophetic time period with another. In fact, the timeline of human history enables us to compare all of the prophetic time periods with one another, as we have back here on the chart of the ages. Okay, now what do we mean by all that? Well, let's talk about another example. Now we're going to have you build a house. You're going to build a house, and you have engaged a crew of three carpenters. Okay, the first carpenter you hired, by the way, you wanted to hire all the best. So the first carpenter you hired is from England. And he brings his toolbox, and in that toolbox is a measuring stick. And that measuring stick is calibrated in perches. Second carpenter you hire is from America. His measuring stick, as we might expect, is calibrated in feet and inches. The third carpenter is from Japan. You know what his measuring stick is calibrated in? Meters. Portions of meters, centimeters. Now, you get all these three guys together and you just turn them loose. What's your house going to look like? A wreck. Now, obviously, the house project is going to be total chaos if these guys don't first get together and agree on what system of measure that they're going to use to build your house and spend your money. Well, again, it's a crude example, but the point we're trying to get at is that we must be able to relate all the various lines of prophecy, all the time prophecies, to the same measuring stick if we're going to understand how one prophetic time period relates to the other. Without this measuring stick, we might be able to understand individual prophecies, but we can't possibly see the panoramic view. We can't possibly see how each one of these is going to interrelate to the other until we find a common timeline, a common measuring stick to put them all together with. Chapter 2, this one sort of has two gems in it. Chapter 2 actually gives us something else that's related to this idea of the measuring stick to compare our prophetic time periods. It gives us the length of the seventh creative day. It shows us that the seventh creative day is 7,000 years and that the last 1,000 is what we refer to as the millennial age, the great Sabbath. How does it do that? You probably all remember the phrase the pastor uses, the venerable tradition. The venerable tradition. The Bible use of 6 plus 1. The Israelites were told to labor and they were told to toil in weariness for 6 days. But on the seventh day, they were refreshed, they were rested from all of their labors. And likewise, for 6,000 years of the seventh creative day, man has been laboring under the dominion of sin and death and groaned under their taskmasters. And it's during the last 1,000 years, the last 1,000 year segment of this creative day, that he's refreshed, he's restored. The venerable tradition. And that's what chapter 2, we believe, gives to us. It gives us that one common measuring stick. It gives us that common denominator, if you will, to work with all of the time prophecies. And it gives us a calibrated timeline that is 7,000 years in length. Okay, let's go on to chapter 3. Fulfillment of time prophecy at the first advent of Christ. At the first advent of Christ. Now, when you first look at this chapter, you don't have to get any further than the title to perhaps come to the conclusion this chapter is totally out of place. This chapter deals with the first advent. Our subject is the second advent. So what's this chapter doing in this book at all? Well, what's the golden gem that we find in this chapter? Well, the golden gem we find here is a key. And you know what a key does? It helps you to unlock a lock. And the key that we find here unlocks the meaning of symbolic time that's used in the scriptures. One symbolic day gives us one literal year. And you know, and this chapter proves this golden gem of one prophetic day equals one literal year in a very simple way. It uses a very simple rule. And that rule is it simply compares history with prophecy. Compares history with prophecy. We take our minds back to Daniel, the ninth chapter. We know when we read through Daniel, the ninth chapter, that Messiah was to come at the end of the 69th week of favor to the Jews. Jesus was to die exactly one half of a week that Daniel mentions, one half of a week later after he came. Well, between the time of Jesus' baptism and the time of his death was to be 3 1/2 prophetic days. Well, we take that prophetic concept out of Daniel, and we compare it to what we clearly know to be in history. History records that from the time of Jesus' baptism until the time of his death was exactly 3.5 years. And so we get the golden gem that's coming out of this chapter. One day in symbolic Bible language gives us one actual year in literal history. And what makes this truth, by the way, so convincing, so real, is that we're looking at a prophecy, clearly a prophecy in Daniel, that has been, no question, that has been fulfilled in history. So we compare prophecy with history, and we come up with this beautiful golden gem. So the first advent teaches us this day for a year concept. That's why we're looking at the first advent. It proves that it's real. It proves that it is accurate and scriptural. But more than this, we think that this golden gem that we extract from this particular chapter is something that we will be able to use with authority as we go throughout not just Daniel, but the other time prophecies in the scriptures. Chapter 4, the times of the Gentiles. Jesus introduces us to the Gentile times in Luke 21:24. Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Well, the Gentile times, as we've learned from our studies, represents a segment of time that has a beginning, has a definite beginning date, a definite length, and therefore a definite ending date. And we know what happens during this period of time, during this segment of time. God leases power. He leases to the Gentiles the power to control or to try to control the affairs of earth for this period of time. And by using a multiple step proof, which we're not going to be able to take the time to go through here with you this morning because we're obviously just touching on the highlights, but by using a multiple step proof that's outlined in the chapter, we learn symbolically, or we learn scripturally, I should say, that all of the chronological features of the Gentile times. We learned 606 B.C., we learned 2,520 years in length, and we learned 1914. And all these conclusions we know were based upon the solid prophetic scriptures that we found given and brought to our attention there, combined with historical facts. Not just history, but again, prophecies combined with historical facts. Well, by the way, without our having learned of this, day for a year concept in the prior chapter, we learned in chapter 3, you know what? We couldn't possibly unlock the secrets of this chapter. Not possibly. We had to learn the day for a year concept before the times of the Gentiles would be able to be unlocked to us as a truth. So we can see why chapter 3 preceded chapter 4. You say, okay, what's the point? Where does all this lead us? What does temporary Gentile rule of the earth have to do with proving that the time is at hand for the Redeemer's kingdom? What's the Gentile times have to do with that? Rule by the Gentiles and rule by Messiah are two completely different things. So what's this chapter doing in this book? What's the connection? We believe that the answer is found in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, and I'm sure you're all familiar with that text. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall stand forever. That's just taking a few pieces out of that verse. But in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. You know, when we go through Daniel, the second chapter, we know what's there. Daniel chapter 2 pictures the Gentile powers as a metallurgical image. The image represents the Gentile governments that Jesus said would have power over the affairs of earth for some period of time. And the Gentile times is when this image would be given its lease of power to operate upon the earth. But the time would come when the image would lose its lease of power. The time would come when it would be over in terms of the affairs of earth. The time was to come when the Gentile governments would no longer wear this crown of power that they had had. And when their lease expired, we know that God would begin to evict them. But before, and this is the key point, but before it would lose its lease of power, God would begin to establish his kingdom. Friends, that's the point. That's the golden gem that we get from this chapter. We don't know precisely when, up to this point in our study from this chapter, we don't know precisely when, but sometime before 1914, the time would be at hand for God to begin establishing his kingdom upon the earth through his Redeemer. Chapter 5, the manner of our Lord's return and appearing. You know, every kingdom has to have a king. You can't have such a thing as a kingdom without having a king. At the time that God would begin, in his wisdom, to begin establishing his kingdom, it's reasonable to conclude that the king would be on the scene. Otherwise, we don't think it would be reasonable to conclude or to assume that the kingdom would begin if there was no king present to run the operation. Now, in chapter 4, as we've just gone over, we learned that sometime before 1914, Jesus was due to return and to commence this kingdom. But what should we expect to see? Before we go any further trying to prove precisely when God would begin to establish this kingdom, we have to pause and we have to learn something about the king. And so in chapter 5, we learn something about the king. We learn something about Jesus. And what we learned was that he will return invisibly. He will not be visible to the fleshly eye. He will return, we're told, as a thief in the night. No human eye is going to see him bodily. But we learn more than that. We learn that Jesus' presence will indeed be manifested through the work that he is doing. In other words, we will see Jesus by the effects of what he is doing in the earth. We understand that at the time Jesus returns, he comes to destroy the enemies. He comes to root out the evil. He comes to establish a kingdom that we know is a kingdom of righteousness. And this is the work that constitutes his second advent object with regard to the earth. And so his second advent is going to be manifested to us as we see these various events going on in the earth. We're going to know, and we do know, that Jesus is present, not by seeing him bodily, but by seeing evil rooted out, by seeing light shining into every dark corner, by seeing the kingdoms of this world beginning to crumble, by seeing everything coming to light, by seeing the increase of knowledge much running to and fro, and you've studied the other signs. Well, maybe we need a little example here, too. Tony and I have had a lot of trouble with moles in our backyard. Now, I honestly can't say that I know that there's a problem with moles back there because I've kind of seen them running around. I honestly don't know if I've ever seen a mole because, you know, they kind of operate underground. They stay out of sight. But you know what? I know they're there. I know they're there because I see their path of destruction. And we feel it every time we mow the grass. Crude example, but it illustrates the way that Jesus' return will be perceived early on. He will be seen. He is seen quite clearly in the flaming fire, in the shout, in the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, with power and with clouds, and all the things that the Apostle Paul told us about. Friends, all these things are symbols. All these things are witnesses or signs of his presence. Again, we're not going to see him with our fleshly eye, but we will certainly see the effects of His presence. And that's the golden gem that we find in chapter 5. Before we are told precisely when the king returns in our study, in progress here, before we are told precisely when he's going to return to take over the affairs of earth, we are informed exactly what it is that we should expect to see and not see. And what we are to expect is a personal and invisible presence. But it's a presence that is manifested in the tumultuous and in the wonderful work that we see going about us accomplished in the earth today. Chapter 6. Earth's Great Jubilee. We now have the stage set. Time, we've already learned, is a vital part of God's plan. We've already built the timeline of human history. We have in hand the key to unlock the meaning of time prophecies. And we know from the Gentile Times study that sometime before 1914, that Jesus is going to return personally. And we know not to expect him bodily. We know we're now prepared to see precisely when God would send his son to begin to establish the kingdom. I would say that for most of us, I know for myself, that chapter 6 is probably the zenith. It's probably the crowning glory of the entire volume. By combining the scriptures in Acts, the third chapter, we're all familiar with Acts 3:19-21. By combining Acts 3:19-21 with the scriptures in Leviticus, the 25th chapter, dealing with the Jubilees, we come to one grand conclusion. Jesus returned to Earth's atmosphere of influence in the fall of 1874, and there began to establish his kingdom on the earth. God inaugurates the kingdom we know in stages. It didn't happen all at once, and it's not going to happen all at once. The early stage of the process, perhaps the earliest stage, we might say, is the return of the king. A further stage is the raising of the sleeping saints. A further stage is the end of the Gentile times, at which time the Lord takes a hand in the affairs of earth, as Brother Russell points out in forward, such as he had never done in the past. The final stage, we know, of the inauguration of the kingdom is when the church is completely glorified, and at that point we believe, we understand, that the remaining vestiges of the old order are going to be quickly done away with, quickly removed, and replaced fully with the new order. And so we find the golden gem in chapter 6. God began to establish the kingdom upon the earth with the return of the king. Chapter 7, the parallel dispensations. The Jewish age and the gospel age, we know, are two distinctly different periods of time. Yet these ages bear a wonderful symmetry, a very wonderful and marvelous relationship to one another, a wonderful correspondency to one another. But they do it, they correspond, the Jewish and the gospel correspond, not in one way, but in two ways. They bear a correspondency with one another in feature, and they bear a correspondency to one another in time. In other words, there are beautiful feature or work correspondencies as well as time correspondencies between the gospel and the Jewish ages. And the first thing that we do as we begin to work our way down through the parallel dispensations study is to note the very distinct and the very strong feature correspondencies. Now, what do we mean by a feature correspondency? Well, take the tabernacle, for example. That's a feature correspondency. We have the priesthood, we have the sacrifices, we have, in leaving the tabernacle, we have the temple. And there are many, many more clearly demonstrate a feature correspondency between the two ages, You and I commonly refer to these as types and antitypes. But by seeing, but on the basis, really, of the strong feature correspondences between these two ages, we reason, and we believe with a basis, we reason that there must likewise be time correspondences between the two ages. Which, of course, is time. You know, time, of course, is our primary interest as we work down through the entire volume. So by studying this particular chapter, we see that the time features of the Jewish age correspond to the time features of the Gospel age. And these time parallels serve one very important function in our study. These time parallels serve a function for us in this volume on the basis of the time features of the divine plan. They operate as a confirmation. And that's the key word. Confirmation of the principal time features of God's plan revealed in the prior chapters of the volume. The date of the second advent is confirmed by the parallels. The date for the beginning of the harvest. The date for the casting off of the nominal house. The date for the ending of the general call. All these key dates and more are beautifully confirmed as we study down through the parallel dispensations. The parallels, we believe, are God's way of eliminating any lingering doubt that we might have in our minds as to the validity and as to the accuracy of the time features of the plan that we've already learned about. The golden gem, we believe, from this chapter is the confirmation of the main time features of the divine plan of the ages. Well, I guess we're all done. We've accomplished our mission, haven't we? Chapters 1 through 6 led us up to one conclusion, that is, the time is at hand for the establishment of the kingdom. And chapter 7 confirmed it. So we're all done, right? Wrong. Problem is, we have a couple spare parts left over. You know how it is when you buy a model car, you know, and you get it home and you start putting it together for your children or your nephew or whatever. And invariably, when you're all done, sometimes there's some parts left over. Proves that maybe something, we didn't do something quite right. Well, these spare parts, friends, we call them chapters 8 and 9. And they're not really spare parts. But it raises a question. What's the function of chapters 8 and 9 relative to the purpose of volume 2? Well, in our view, it's our view that the seventh messenger is, and I know we've all experienced this, he's very comprehensive and very thorough in his teachings. And we found that he first presents a plain line of thought to support a particular point that needs to be supported. But does he always stop there after he presents that one line of simple truth to preserve or to make a point? No, he doesn't always stop there. He looks around and he sees if there are any scriptures that appear on their face to oppose the conclusion that are seemingly taught by the scriptures that were just presented. And you know what he calls these? Supposed objections. Supposed objections. And we find this study approach throughout the Harvest Message. And in particular, you will find the supposed objections particularly being referenced in Volume 5, page 263. Today we present the thought that chapters 8 and 9 in this study play the role of the supposed objections to our conclusion. In fact, they play the supposed objection role to the entire volume. Each of these two chapters identifies a different scripture that seems to oppose the conclusion that Jesus returned in the fall of 1874 and commenced the establishment of the kingdom. So let's take a look at chapter 8. Elias must first come. The chapter, this particular chapter, number 8, tacitly presents the thought that Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, which we're going to turn to in a moment, that these scriptures present a supposed objection that Jesus returned in 1874 and commenced the kingdom. Let's turn, if we will, to Malachi chapter 4 and read verses 5 and 6. Malachi 4, 5 and 6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now note in particular verse 5 in your scriptures. The day of the Lord positively, unconditionally, cannot begin until Elijah has come. If Elijah has not come, Jesus is not present. The purpose of chapter 8 is to determine whether the prophetic Elijah, the Elijah that Malachi is referring to, came before 1874. If the prophetic Elijah came before 1874, there's no objection to the main conclusion of our study. If the prophetic Elijah did not come before 1874, then our one main conclusion that pervades the entire volume is wrong. But an honest study as we get down through the Elias chapter reveals that there is no problem. The supposed objection isn't really an objection at all as we go down through the study. Because the first thing that we learn about this particular study is who the prophetic Elijah is. The Elijah of Malachi is not the literal man, Elijah. That's not who Malachi is referring to. The Elijah of Malachi, as we go down through the various proofs presented, we prove to ourselves that the prophetic Elijah is the church in the flesh. We learn what the Elijah message consists of. This message, we could characterize it as being a message of reconciliation, as we glean from 1 Kings chapter 18. And that's a beautiful study. If you want to go back and just touch on that as you have an opportunity. 1 Kings chapter 18. You can see the work that the man Elijah did, which helps us to see what the message of the prophetic Elijah would be. It is. Well, beginning many years before 1874, the faithful ones of that era began preaching the message of the gospel all over the world. We know that only a few heeded that message. There wasn't a lot of conversion done by it. There was only a few that were reconciled to God. There were only a few that were turned back to God as a result of the message that the church in the flesh had given. But our point is not how many were turned back to God or reconciled. The point is that the faithful ones in the flesh appeared on the scene before 1874, and they began delivering God's message everywhere on the globe that they possibly could. And the pages of history will bear out that fact, that conclusion. We know of the Bible societies. We know of the enormous Bible translation work that occurred during this time. The reformers, the preaching, the vigorous studying, the renewed interest in the Second Advent. All of this occurred before 1874. And so we have the golden gem from chapter 8. God did indeed send the prophetic Elijah, the real Elijah, before 1874, before the beginning of the day of the Lord that's brought to our attention by Malachi. The real Elijah tried to prepare the world for the day of the Lord. They faithfully delivered, and they've continued to deliver, God's message of reconciliation throughout the earth, just as was predicted in verse 6. So Malachi chapter 4 poses no objection to the basic fact that we have been working on, the basic premise that the time was indeed at hand in the fall of 1874. Chapter 9. We know that chapter 9 is the longest chapter in the entire volume. It's nearly 100 pages, as I recall. The man of sin, Antichrist. That's just old stuff, right? Doesn't really do much for us. Not at all. Very relevant, very timely, very important to the integrity of the entire volume and the integrity of the conclusion that that volume presents. The theme scripture of chapter 9 is given to us in 2 Thessalonians, and we'd like to turn to that with you. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. In fact, we'll read verse 1 as well, just for a little context. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. And now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that ye be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter, as from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Our suggestion and our understanding is that these scriptures Paul is referring to and the entire chapter 9, is a supposed objection to the second advent, to the date 1874. We know that this discourse from our studies in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is Paul's unanswerable veto, his unanswerable veto to the second advent. Paul told the brethren that the day of Christ, the second advent is what he was referring to here, could not commence until after there was a falling away. And until after the man of sin would rise to power. And after that man of sin actually would be on the decline. All these things had to take place before it would be time for the day of the Lord, the second advent. And so the supposed objection is this. Was there a falling away prior to 1874? Did a force or a power that fit Paul's description appear on the scene? Did it come into being before 1874? Did this power rise up and do an awful work? And was this power smitten, and was it on the decline before 1874? If we can answer yes to all of these questions that Paul points to in his discourse on this subject, then Paul has no objection to the conclusion that Jesus did indeed return in 1874 and began there to establish the kingdom. But if we answer no to any one of those questions, the falling away, a rising to power, a smiting, and being on the decline. If we answer no to any one of those questions, then the second advent has not yet begun according to Paul's discourse. Well, chapter 9, which as we mentioned, is quite lengthy. And it gives us that one main golden gem. The supposed objection here is not an objection at all, once we work down through a very laborious study. Interesting, but it's laborious. It's long. And we certainly admit that. But it's very revealing. Because we believe that after we go through this study, if the Apostle Paul were up here on this platform today, speaking to you, instead of me, he would wholeheartedly agree, we believe, that the time indeed is at hand. We believe that that's what Paul would be saying today, August 1993. He wouldn't be objecting any longer to the brethren, to you and I, accepting the fact of the second advent. The predicted falling away has occurred. And it occurred several hundred years, during the first several hundred years after Jesus' death. The Antichrist, we know, came into being. The Antichrist rose to the chief spiritual seat in around the year 800 AD. And between 800 and 1800, as we go down through the study, we see that Antichrist counterfeited nearly every aspect of Christ's true kingdom, was counterfeited during that roughly 1,000 year segment of time. Antichrist perpetrated its gross blasphemies on God's character, upon His word, upon His plan. And we know through the terrible experiences that were suffered during that period from 800 to 1800 that Antichrist indeed did wear out the saints of the Most High through its teachings. We know that indeed Antichrist made war with the saints, as we're told in the scripture, through the persecutions, through the inquisitions, through the literal massacres that those brethren went through. But we know with the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte, that the Antichrist was wounded and it began to lose much of its power right around 1800. In short, when we look down through the pages of history and we compare it with what Paul was talking about in his discourse, all of Paul's predictions appear to us to be fulfilled and were fulfilled before 1874. Everything that he said that should happen before the day of the Lord would begin did in fact happen before autumn 1874. And so, friends, that's the golden gem. Everything that God designed to happen before the second advent respecting the Antichrist, the man of sin, did in fact occur. And that's what we're looking for as we go down through a study that takes quite a while to get through. And so, as we get down through the chapter 9, we find that really, there's really nothing respecting this entire subject of the Antichrist that any longer stands as an objection to the beginning of the establishment of the kingdom with the return of the king in 1874. In summary, in our minds, the brilliance of the gems that we find in this portion of the harvest message are now glowing in our minds brighter than ever. When we take the time to study, and when we take the time to observe each gem separately, we see the magnificence, we see the beauty of each gem as it's laid out before us, one by one. We see the symmetry of that gem, we see the perfection. But more than that, when we group all 10 of these gems together and we line them up and we see the interrelationships between them, the combined brilliance is brighter than the sun at noonday, just to borrow a phrase from the Apostle Paul. Extremely bright. And the brilliance of these 10 gems are what's lighting our path. Your path and my path are being lit by these gems, so to speak, at the present time. These gems that we've just looked at, they show us where we have come from. These gems show us where we are. These gems show us where we are going. And they tell us what you and I should be busy laboring at. But above all, friends, these 10 gems in our minds, as we get down through them, when we look at the scriptural foundations for each one, these 10 gems that we've looked at prove to us that they are not of man, but that they are of God.